gourmet jams, and specialty baked goods. Decorate your home with beautiful baskets, bright flowers, and gardening decor from community artists. The West Dearborn Farmers and Artisans Market is sponsored by Henry Ford Community College and the City of Dearborn every Friday from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. behind the Bryant Branch Library at the corner of Michigan Avenue and Mason Street. Get everything you need for a great weekend at the West Dearborn Farmers and Artisans Market and make it a Friday tradition.
Would it be crazy if you packed your bags and left for a week, a month, a year? What if you left for 2 years? What if you were going far away to help in a village on the edge of the Gobi Desert? To spend time with people the rest of the world only reads about? To teach children and learn a thing or two about yourself? Would that be crazy? Peace Corps. Life is calling. How far will you go? To find out more, call 1-800-424-8580 or visit peacecorps.gov.
Men, make sure you're around for your families. Get the test you need at the doctor. Disease can be detected early and treated. For a list of medical tests every man should have, go to ahrq.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
If you want to change the world, then you have to change yourself. One of the best places in the Metro Detroit area to improve your life is Henry Ford Community College. Henry Ford Community College offers dozens of degree and certificate programs, plus the opportunity to network with your peers and potential employers. Taking classes at Henry Ford Community College gives you the freedom to take your own career path and opens up an infinite number of career possibilities. Additionally, day and evening classes allow you the flexibility of building a schedule tailored to your busy lifestyle. So change the world, change yourself at Henry Ford Community College. For more information on admittance and financial aid and class schedules, call the Henry Ford Community College toll-free number at 1-800-585-HFCC. Again, that's 1-800-585-HFCC.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford Community College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. Hi, I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. Back in September of 2008, documentary filmmaker James Fox was on the show talking about his latest movie, Out of the Blue. And at the time, he was working on a follow-up film that was yet untitled. And that documentary was subsequently completed, and Mr. Fox did come up with a title. It's a phrase you'll hear from virtually everyone who has witnessed an unconventional craft in our skies that seems to defy the laws of physics and aerodynamics. I know what I saw. And you may have seen the documentary on History Channel a while back. And here to tell us about it and his most recent endeavor, documenting the Horizon oil disaster in the Gulf, is Mr. James Fox. Welcome back to the show, Mr. Fox.
Thank you for having me on, and Yeah, the Gulf oil spill, which we'll go into a bit later, it certainly is a colossal disaster. Speaking with people from Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama to Florida, and it's just affecting everyone's lives.
Well, let's switch gears here and talk about that the first part of the show then. You're out there in Louisiana right now, right?
Yes.
Okay. Whereabouts?
Right now I'm in New Orleans. Yesterday we actually went down to Grand Isle.
Okay.
And we collected some oil samples from the beaches of Grand Isle as well as connected with, in a local bar,
a gentleman
who's part of the cleanup crew.
Okay.
Who'd been out laying boom about 20 miles out in a boat, and there was these massive, I'm sure you've all heard about these oil, underwater oil plumes.
Mm.
And they had the consistency of peanut butter.
Oh.
And they, according to these toxicologists and marine biologists that I've talked to, Dr. Carl Safina, Dr. Ricky Ott, these oil is doing things that they never thought, it's baffling scientists. And because of these dispersants they're putting in the oil, they're doing it at 5,000 feet, which has never been done, and also spraying these dispersants, which are known carcinogens, Corexit being one of them.
Right.
So the oil is doing things they just never imagined.
Like what?
Well, it's going below the surface. It's sinking. Like when these big plumes, some of them are several miles across by 30 plus miles long. They heat up during the daytime and they come up closer to the surface, and then at night they seep down and they're just these pockets of death, pretty much. Apparently, there are these microorganisms, these hydrocarbon eating organisms that do consume oil, but the problem is at those depths they consume also oxygen, so it creates these vacuums, these voids of oxygen, these literally death zones, and so it's doing things. It's a huge experiment, so it's taking a very, very bad situation and making it much, much worse using these dispersants.
So are they saying now that it's doing the exact opposite of what they wanted it to do? It's going to be harder to clean up.
According to what I've talked to, I mean, first of all, you can't stop oil with booms if the oil's below the surface.
That's right.
And secondly, according to the marine biologists, toxicologists that I've spoken to, the only thing the dispersants do is hide the magnitude of the spill itself.
Oh.
And then once the oil is down below the surface, anything goes.
So in other words, from the surface of the water, you can look out and say, see, we've cleaned it up, but actually it's all still there. It's just down on the bottom.
Well, the analogy that Dr. Ricky Ott, who worked at the Exxon Valdez oil spill 20 years ago, used was, you can imagine a bird poop on your windscreen of your car.
Hmm.
Well, you've got to contain bird poop, but if you put your window wipers on, and now it spreads all over the whole windscreen.
Hmm.
And that's what they're doing. You're not making the oil go anywhere.
Oh, my. When you said that it has the consistency of peanut butter, I thought, well, gee, that would make it really easy to clean up as opposed to runny oil. But it doesn't sound like that now, does it?
Well, you can't suck it up.
No.
And then, you've got something that's all... And the sample that I got, the cleanup crew worker whose name will remain out of the picture, because he's very, very worried about BP finding out that he's giving me these samples.
Mm. He works for BP, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
He put his hand in the water and literally had to break some of it off and then force it in the jar. Oh. And his hand has been burning ever since.
Oh.
Really, really toxic. And we took some of these samples and we sent them out FedEx today to a lab in California, where they're going to be looking for the presence of benzene, concentration of benzene. Apparently, if it's at all detected, it's highly toxic. These obviously could, in a storm, which we're starting to experience now in the area, these, coupled with the dispersants, the benzene, all these toxins in the water, will become airborne and dispersed over a very, very large area. So the word I got from Dr. Ricky Ott said that if a hurricane hits, get out of town in no uncertain words.
Well, also, wouldn't that go up into the air, into the clouds, and rain down?
Absolutely. There's talk here now, actually, of it raining oil. I've talked to a bunch of locals today.
Not only oil, but the chemicals they're using, the Corexit and whatever, the chemicals they're using to try to disperse it or hide it, shall we say, will come raining down as well.
Yeah, absolutely. They're saying the hurricane, high temperatures can result in these toxic vapors. The lab that we're working with right now is using a process called headspace gas chromatograph. Sorry.
Try that again.
Chromatograph.
Yeah, easy for you to say.
And I'm looking at it.
But, what is that supposed to do?
He's going to, like I said, he's going to detect for, it's oil and HDO testing for benzene.
Mm-hmm.
And he said if it's at all detectable, then that's really bad news.
Mm-hmm.
And these workers are out there without gas masks, without any protection whatsoever. And they basically gave me these oil samples. I gathered some myself on the beach of the Grand Isle, but this one from 20 miles out should be very, very significant. Because they want to know. They're like, please let us know if we're out there working with these materials without the proper hazmat suits or gas masks. We want to know. So they're not warning the workers at all about this. These workers are out there without any masks whatsoever. There are these massive plumes of oil just off the shores. There's like this film of oil. It's so disgusting. On the beach yesterday at Grand Isle, and I'm sorry about our interview yesterday, the problems we had with that, because I was out there collecting samples.
Yeah.
But the beaches are just like, there's just oil in the sand, there's just this layer of film over all the water, just in every direction.
Mm.
It's like a toxic soup, and the smell in the air is kind of burns your eyes a little bit, and your nasals. Like my sister had a really bad sore throat after coming back from Grand Isle.
Oh, no.
They've got a high presence of military, it looks like maybe the National Guard. And no one's really talking to anyone. Like, you talk to the cleanup crew. Oh, well, we don't know what National Guard's doing here. Well, what about these guys? I'm not sure. It's, like, very compartmentalized. And no one's allowed to talk to the media out there. It's I'm amazed that our government is allowing BP to do the cleanup work. They haven't stepped in. There's no transparency.
When I spoke to you on the phone last week setting up this interview, you said something about someone was arresting people who were taking pictures. Did I hear you right?
Yes. So what I was told.
Who was arresting people?
Well, we think it's under it's Wackenhut Security has been hired by BP. Hmm. Now, from what I've been told is that even the very workers are going through, they're screening them, making sure they're not taking any photographs of what they're seeing. They can't talk about what they're experiencing, any part of the cleanup, to anybody. They're worried about losing their jobs. But from what I understand, I haven't seen it with my own eyes, but from what I understand, Wackenhut Security, I don't think it's the local police, quite possibly are doing this, and under this guise of safety, it's for your safety. You cannot be in these areas, these closed-off areas. And I saw lots of signs saying these areas are closed off, no entry, cannot enter, all over. Of course, we went right in, but...
because you're James Fox.
Well, I mean, were they going to arrest me while my camera's rolling, please?
Yeah, right.
But, no, you talk to... I mean, seriously, you talk to the people that are out there in the cleanup crew, and they're terrified of talking at all with any reporters, don't bring any cameras, you know. We went into a local bar, had a few drinks with them, which turned out to be a very good idea because, you know, as soon as these workers got a couple drinks, and then they kind of opened up. There are no cameras, no recording devices, and...
Mm.
And the feeling basically is that, you know, it's a very kind of that you know, they're under strict orders not to talk about what they're doing.
Hmm. And the reason for that being,
I don't know, my guess is as good as yours, but I think that BP is completely overwhelmed. I think that
that goes without saying.
Yeah, right. The cleanup. I think they're doing the best they can to hide the magnitude of this spill and the impact it's going to have. The fact that they're out there without any masks whatsoever. I mean, I was out there on the beaches just for about 15 minutes, and I could feel it. These guys are out there working all day long in the hot sun.
Yeah,
it's really it's hot out here. It's like 105 degrees. Right now it's a little cooler because we've got some storms, but it's very, very warm.
Yeah, and the storms could be the worst thing.
Absolutely. You know, like I said, I've heard of people in the New Orleans area talking about this rain, this oily rain coming down right now. I haven't seen it with my own eyes yet, but I've heard it from a number of people, locals.
And they can feel this in the water, in the rain?
Yeah, they can see it.
Oh, they can
see seeing it. Rainbows or seeing like, yeah.
Oh my God!
You know, like you pour a little oil on the ground and you put water on it, you can see the. Yeah, that's what it looks like, according to people I've talked to. Yes.
You know, you'd think that BP had kind of learned a lesson from being chintzy with, trying to save a buck here and there caused the thing in the first place. And now they're putting them out there without the proper gear, without hazmat suits or masks for breathing and what have you. There's going to be more lawsuits. There's going to be more deaths. There's going to be more physical, medical problems with their own workers. Am I right?
They talk about these cleanup crews, and I've filmed from the air the Ground Zero and surrounding areas, Grand Isle,
right.
Two different occasions. One of the times I was actually with Dr. Carl Safina, and if anyone out there would like to do a search on YouTube, it's just under Dr. Safina. You'll see the video that we shot from a seaplane. It's S is in Sam, A, F is in Frank, I, N is in Nancy, A, Dr. Safina. You can get a pretty good idea of the magnitude of this spill. And the cleanup crew, as far as I can tell, is more a dog and pony show. I mean, we're talking millions of gallons getting pumped into the Gulf every single day. Mm. We're not going to scoop that stuff off the beaches with a couple of vacuum cleaners, shop vacs that they've gotten from Home Depot.
Yeah, I've seen them on the news picking up these little glumps and, a handful of people picking up these little glumps. I mean,
40, 60, possibly 80,000 barrels a day.
Yeah.
And it's free-flowing, pumping right in the Gulf as we speak right now. There's no cap on it, just pumping millions of gallons out.
So that cap they put on just didn't work, right?
Well, they had to take it off because of the storm. Pretty much everything is at a halt right now. The geyser is just pumping away right now, right into the Gulf.
And you also said something on the phone with me about this interview with President Obama that
yes.
they went on the news, I guess,
mm-hmm.
was another dog and pony show. What did you mean by that?
Well, it's pretty much a known fact, if you're out here and talk to the locals, that the staging of some people in hazmat suits on the beach behind him at Grand Isle a couple of weeks ago
mm-hmm.
was exactly that. It was staged. BP, I talked to a woman whose best friend at the hotel I was staying at in Houma, and she said that her best friend was asked to put this hazmat suit on and basically look like they're doing some cleanup on the beaches behind President Obama, and it was all staged.
And when the cameras stopped rolling, everybody went home?
Exactly.
Back to their trailer and
exactly.
called for makeup? Is that it?
Yeah, and this whole idea of like just cleaning up off the beaches, I cannot emphasize the magnitude of this spill. It's like a Valdez every 5 or 6 days. You are not going to, I'm sorry, but you are just not going to suction with vacuum cleaners this stuff off the beaches. How in the world are you going to do, I mean, it's so big, they're going to have to think of something else. I mean,
I hate to say it, but it sounds like, not only the beaches, not only the area where the water comes up with the oil, but just going up into the air, raining for how far out? I mean, across the world, as far as the clouds can carry it?
Gosh, this is something that I should, I'm going to actually meet up with Dr. Safina in the next couple of days, and I can address, and if anybody out there listening has any questions or anything in particular they'd like me to address while I'm here, I'd be glad to. Just you can Google me or just email me at jamescfox@gmail.com, jamescfox@gmail.com, and I'd be glad to answer any questions, or and if I don't have the answer, I'll go out and find it.
Yeah. How long do you plan on being out there?
A couple more weeks. Mm-hmm. I spent a couple weeks out here already. I had to go home and kind of regroup, and I'm back out here for a couple more weeks. I'll be traveling to Alabama tomorrow, Mississippi, possibly Florida, Pensacola,
wow.
and meeting with locals, fishermen, store shop owners, restaurant people, kind of all of the above.
Yeah, I think it's the people that are going to give you straighter answers than BP, don't you think?
People are so upset everywhere you go.
Yeah.
You'd think with an oil spill of this magnitude, I shouldn't even call it a spill, because a spill is a contained amount.
Mm.
But with a disaster of this magnitude, there'd be all hands on deck. And for the most part, there's very, very little effort for cleanup. I think they're just so overwhelmed. And a lot of people, I'm going to interview a mayor of Magnolia Springs in Alabama in the next couple of days. But he took matters into his own hands and blocked off the pass to the inlets in these marshes and estuaries with barges and boom because the government just wasn't doing it. I mean, what are they waiting for?
Yeah.
72 days, 73 days?
I heard something about, you know, they're not giving us permission to do this. Why do they need permission to protect their own state, their own towns, and their own beaches? Why do they need permission? From whom?
Isn't it amazing? I mean, the fact that the EPA has asked BP to stop using these dispersants, find something less toxic,
right?
They asked them back in May. And they're still using these things.
Good Lord.
It's like, who's in control here?
I understand that Corexit was banned in England.
Yes. The very company that, that's where BP's from. And yet, they just happen to own the company that has these dispersants. Millions of gallons in a warehouse.
Oh, I see. Well, they might as well make a little profit on that while they're at it, eh?
Right.
Good Lord. Do you have a title for this documentary?
I do not. What I've been doing primarily is I've been out here and I've been documenting stuff and putting it directly up on YouTube because I feel like time is of the essence.
Yeah.
So I've been documenting it and I put up about 50% of the content I get daily. A lot of times I'll shoot during the day and at night I'll edit all night and then I'll post it up. We've been getting pretty good hits, a lot of feedback, a lot of new leads. Obviously these things take time, but people have been very grateful that, you know, I mean, it's what little I have to offer, but to give the people a voice.
And do you
because they're feeling like, you know, it's very frustrating. They're just not being heard.
Oh, yeah. Do you have an outlet for this? Do you have a market for this documentary when it's done?
You know, I don't know. I think the information getting out there as quickly as possible. I've been using YouTube.
Yeah.
I've been getting thousands and thousands and thousands of hits all over. Mm. That's been very helpful. I've been doing radio interviews. I've been sending out DVDs of the footage I've gotten to all news organizations all across the country.
Right.
I've been contacting CNN and giving them leads. They've been giving me leads.
Mm.
You know, I'm just doing what I can, you know, hoping that I can make a little bit of a difference.
Right, right. Well, let us know when you have that in the can, so to speak. And
By the way, if anyone out there, if you go to James C. Fox on YouTube, and you can see, I think I've got about 8, 9, 10 videos posted of anywhere from Florida, Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi. And if you like what you see, you can go to my website, IKnowWhatISawTheMovie.com. If you buy one of my DVDs, you'll just know that 100% of the proceeds keep me in the Gulf.
Keep you in the Gulf. So it's pretty much a non-profit organization.
It's what I can do. It's what I can do. I feel like, you know, I couldn't no longer sit on the sidelines and watch this nightmare unfold without jumping down here and helping out.
And they haven't tried to stop you, have they?
No, and what we're focusing on right now is we're trying to dispel the myth about these dispersants. I don't know if you've seen the latest ads with BP, but they're talking about, you know, they've spent millions of dollars, probably almost as much as they spent, you know, in compensation funds on trying to project this image that they're doing something.
Mm.
We're here to keep your beaches clean, you know, these kind of propaganda.
Right, right.
So we want to dispel the myth about these dispersants, really get the information out there about that.
All right.
We also, like I said earlier, we took these oil samples and we sent them to a lab, very kindly have offered to do this all pro bono, and they're going to give us a preliminary analysis, which I should have by Monday or Tuesday, of what's in the oil, and then they're going to do a more detailed analysis, which will take a few weeks to try to detect these dispersants. So those are my two goals right now.
Mm. And when people start dying in the Gulf from this raining oil, they'll say it's because of fifth-hand smoke or something. I don't know.
right. The use of Pine Sol.
Use of Pine Sol.
Bad, too, because when you're out here, you see some of the news coverage. And primarily, I mean, for the most part, the news coverage, they don't really go like, you'll see, you know, CNN or, I mean, there are some exceptions, but you'll see CNN and you'll see Fox News and whatever, and they have these certain areas where they go to and they just kind of report from the hill. They don't actually go down onto the beaches as such.
Wow.
I mean, I'm not saying categorically, but for the most part what I've seen, you know, and I talk to I'll get them in between takes. Hey guys, are you here to report about these toxic dispersants, the EPA, the fact that the EPA is asking to stop, they continue doing it? Have you talked about these underwater plumes of oil? Like, address these other issues. Oh no, we're just here to, you know, BBC, Fox News, we're just here to just, you know, just talk about our beaches, you know, how you know, basically just try to bring people down. And it's really depressing.
It is.
You know, they're not willing to roll their sleeves up and get down there and really find out what's going on and talk to locals. I don't know.
Yeah, but you are, and I hope to see this documentary soon. I've got to take a short break here just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, 89.3 FM on your radio, and WHFR.FM on your computer.
I'm a doctor.
I'm a teacher.
I live in the South.
California is my home.
I speak fluent Spanish.
No hablo español.
I have brown eyes.
My eyes are blue.
We're very different people, but we do have something in common. I made a donation to the Red Cross.
When disaster struck and I needed help, her gift to the American Red Cross changed my life.
When you support the American Red Cross, you change a life, starting with your own.
Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org and find out about life-changing opportunities in your area.
And this is We Are Not Alone. I am David Twitchell, and we're speaking with documentary filmmaker James Fox. And he is doing the documentary on the oil disaster, not oil spill, oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. And the effect that it's having on our country and all over the world, actually. Not only environmentally, but economically. And but now we're going to switch gears again, if we can, James, and talk about your other documentary, I Know What I Saw. You were in Washington, D.C., and you met with some very high-profile individuals there at the National Press Club. Tell us about that.
Well, Leslie Keene and I put this event on at the National Press Club, where we flew in 12 people from 7 countries, high-ranking military and government officials from around the world to testify at the National Press Club. And then I documented this whole thing on HD. Mm-hmm. And we flew, most of the people stayed there for at least 3 days, possibly up to 5 days. So we did, you know, independent interviews and everything. And I was the idea was to, obviously we got some press, we did a Larry King show about it a couple days prior. You know, there was press and media at the actual event itself, the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. But on top of that, I wanted to take that footage, take that material, and incorporate it into Out of the Blue. That was my initial idea, because I was revamping Out of the Blue at the time. But then Out of the Blue sort of evolves into something somewhat different. I remember getting a lot of media coverage at the time, 2007, 2008, and I got an agent in L.A., and they said, oh, you know, I'd worked so hard on revamp, and we spent like 2 straight years revamping Out of the Blue, which I thought was going to take a few months, and it took like 2 years, and this agent kind of got on board, and wow, you know, amazing film, and Out of the Blue at that point was done and ready to be released. And they said, oh, you know, if you, this is a great film, but if you could just go back to the drawing board and do some additional interviews and backup stuff and do more traveling, and you know, we think you could really have something great here. And I remember thinking, are you crazy? I am so done right now. I can't go any further. My God, I'm exhausted. My partners have back, you know, I had to buy them out and keep generating more money. And I was really at the end of my rope. But I thought, well, I'm in it this far. I might as well keep pushing forward.
All right.
So we went another 2 years, and that was the birth of I Know What I Saw. And by the way, where I got that title from, I kept saying, the title will come. It'll come. I'll know it when I hear it. Mm-hmm. And I kept hearing in the editing room, don't tell me what I saw, I know what I saw.
Mm-hmm.
From so many different witnesses, and I thought, there we go.
Yeah.
That's a good catchy title. That's how it came about.
Yeah, very good. I know we were kibitzing on the show when you were on last time about a title, and I was trying to help you come up with a title, but nothing really worked. But that was genius because, you know, I'm an investigator here for MUFON. And,
Somebody want to talk to you about MUFON, just to plant the seed, to remind me to talk to you about it, but carry on.
Okay. But I hear that a lot from people who say, you know, I'll call them to follow up on their report to MUFON, and they'll say, I wasn't drinking, I don't do drugs, I'm not crazy, I know what I saw. I know what I saw. I keep hearing that, and so do you.
Absolutely do.
You know, and from a lot of people, they'll say, oh, you must have seen an airplane. You must have seen a weather balloon. Do they still have weather balloons, by the way?
Gee, I haven't seen one in years.
You know, they've got satellites
You'd
up
think
there.
With all those high-tech satellites, we wouldn't need them anymore.
Why would they need a balloon?
Right.
You know? But I guess the weather balloon story still works, so... yeah, tell me about MUFON.
Okay, well, here's... This is... I take this quite seriously, what I'm about to share with your listeners. This is something that's not just popped up and I'm sharing. This is the first time I'm actually talking about it publicly. But I think it's time, I really think it's time for disclosure on this whole thing. And I've been thinking about this long and hard, about how we can go about doing it. And the unfortunate thing with this field is that there's so much sort of inside bickering among researchers and ufologists, and I find that very frustrating, and I just refuse to engage in any of it.
Politics.
The politics of it all, exactly. And I think that at this point, what I'd like to see happen, what I'd like to help make happen, is to sort of consolidate our resources and our efforts and focus on a common goal. I think we can do that.
Mm.
Try and keep the goal somewhat conservative in the sense that let's not talk about babies floating in incubators out in space or the abduction stuff. All the things that provoke a knee-jerk response in mainstream media, keep it conservative. Not because the information isn't valid, but know that for the most part, when we start talking about the inner workings of possibly what's going on, the deep core level of the phenomenon, it just freaks people out.
It does.
And they run away from it.
It does.
So, if we could keep it down to, let's talk about structured craft of unknown origin, or let's particularly maybe focus in on one case, maybe the Bentwaters case, which I feel quite strongly has all the ingredients to possibly get congressional hearings at the landing of a case. You got all the officers that touched it, saw it on the ground. You got over 100 plus witnesses who witnessed the takeoff. You got comments from the general, from the colonel, deputy base commander, Colonel Charles Hart, all the rest of it. You got the release of documents through MOD. There's up for review right now as we speak, 30 years. It's the 30-year anniversary coming up in December for the Pentwaters-Rendlesham Forest case. Possibly a lot of documents are going to be declassified. I've been talking to Jim Pennison about this. Maybe we can take that case in particular, because there's so many cases out there, that case in particular, and combine our resources, get every MUFON in every state. I don't know how many there are.
How many states are there?
Exactly. Get to work together and organize a march on Washington, and the focal point possibly could be congressional hearings for the Bentwaters case. I know there's so many cases, so many great cases out there, but that's a really solid case. It's just long enough ago now where witnesses are comfortable to talk about it, but they're not too old.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? You've got a landing of an object. You've got people walking around expecting it. You've got the imprints in the ground. You've got the radiation readings. You've got the MOD reports. You've got a lot of more new witnesses coming out now. You've got the 30-year anniversary coming up. Let's have a march on Washington, D.C. Can we get 2,000 people from each state working together with MUFON, focus on a common goal, combine our resources, and make this happen?
That is
what I'd like to see happen, and I'd like to see happen in a year.
That sounds good. That sounds good. Can you, it would sound more impressive coming from you than it would me. Why not contact MUFON headquarters?
That's exactly what I've just been, this is the first time I've been talking about this publicly. I've been thinking about it for about 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
It would have to be very, very well orchestrated, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But if we could do a goal of, say, 2,000 people per state through MUFON, you know, we get MUFON, local MUFONs to work on their states or their regions and have a very, maybe, like I said, maybe focus on just one case. Let's just focus on the Bentwaters case.
Right.
Let's push for congressional hearing. Let's demand transparency. Let's do it now. I mean, what are we waiting for?
Right.
It's not going to happen without us making it happen.
Yeah. I've had Larry Warren on the TV version of We Are Not Alone.
Yes.
I've had Peter Robbins on the radio version, and coincidentally, if I can give a plug here, Peter Robbins will be in Dearborn on September 18th, and he's speaking right here at Henry Ford Community College. So,
wow.
Maybe you can make it out.
When is that going to be?
September 18th.
I might be around. There might be around. I, I'm going to be working kind of behind the scenes on this idea that I have.
Yeah.
I just need to think very carefully on how to execute it.
Right.
This is the first time I've talked publicly about it.
Right.
I'm happy to do so. I wouldn't talk about it publicly if I wasn't very serious about making it happen.
Right.
Maybe I'm just naive enough to think I could pull it off. Then again, I was just naive enough to think I could pull I Know What I Saw.
I know, and out of the blue.
And out of the blue.
You know, and there it is, you know. And
nothing shy of a miracle that film made it out. I could make a documentary about the making of I Know What I Saw. The obstacles I had to get around were monumental.
I tell you, you know, you think, well, gee, what am I going to have in this documentary on UFOs? Because they keep claiming there's no evidence on enough evidence on UFOs, nothing solid. And you go out and make Out of the Blue. You go out and make I Know What I Saw. People come out of the woodwork. I mean, not just, you know, Joe Blow in out in his field, but astronauts and pilots and ex-governors and oh my goodness, you know.
Did you watch it on History Channel?
Oh yeah, sure.
They've aired it a bunch of times. They usually air it about every 6 weeks.
Right, right.
They also aired it on History International. And funny enough, the film, it rated okay in the States, and it rated extremely well in Europe.
Did it?
Yeah, and I'm wondering why that is. Do you think it's because it's not the quintessential format for a documentary in the U.S.? Like, I watch a lot of, oh, not a lot, but a little TV. I don't even have TV at my house, but when I do watch TV, I'm amazed at, like, the standard, the it's like rapid edits, flashy graphics, and really, at the end of the day, not a whole lot of content.
Yeah. Yeah,
kind of
frustrating. I noticed
you feel like, you don't feel like you've gathered, like I watched, and I'm not trying to bash UFO hunters by any means, but I just feel like you walk away with it knowing less than you did before you watched the show.
I don't know.
Yeah. And it's not.
I like that show.
It's not the people's fault that are Bill Burns and all the people that are involved with Pat Oskar. I know that they truly care about what they're doing, but you know, you've got the, you know, it's controlled by History Channel or the editors, and that's the format, and that's the formula that that they adhere to.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it most, you know, they don't have the attention span to watch something for a couple of minutes or something. They have to see flashes of it, you know?
Well, I think they used to. I mean, you know, one of the last, you know, few shows I find with lots of great integrity, reporting integrity, the 60 Minutes, Frontline, they actually dig in deep to these, to certain issues. I'd love to see Frontline do something on UFOs. I'd love to see 60 Minutes dig their teeth into UFOs. You remember the Peter Jennings piece?
Oh, my, yeah.
Peter Jennings was saying before he died that he felt that UFOs were real.
Was he?
Well, yeah, because after looking into it, it's very difficult not to.
Well, this is it. Well, you found that out, didn't you?
Absolutely. You know, my father was my biggest skeptic.
Yeah?
Yeah, he's a mainstream journalist, and he was like, you know, son, really, you know, don't do it. You know, you're going down a dead-end street, and there's nothing to it, and my God, you're wasting your life. And that fueled the fire even more.
Well, Alan Hynek was the biggest skeptic you ever want to see until he was forced to look at the evidence. And now he, you know, before his death, he was the pro-UFO.
We got a great interview. You know, it was wonderful. I was on Larry King, and I put a message out to anybody out there that had some great footage or any kind of, you know, material that we might want to use in the making of the film.
Right.
What a great platform that was. You know, Larry King, he's hanging up his suspenders.
Yeah, I hear that.
Yeah, in the fall. But I got contacted by this gentleman who said, I've got this interview from Dr. Jalen Hynek. It's been sitting collecting dust on my shelf for 30 years. And I'd like to give it to you for free.
Oh.
So we did. So we got this amazing, I just had to pay the transfer fees. That was it. Got that amazing interview with Dr. Hynek. And it was funny, actually, at this section that I'm going to refer to, that I'm referring to now, actually, didn't end up making it in the movie, but it was funny. You know, he talks about the basis for Close Encounters of the Third Kind, a lot of that work. Mm. A lot of the cases came directly out of Project Blue Book files, even the description of the beings and whatnot. But he said, you know, a lot of people say, well, gosh, you know, if these things were real, why don't they just land on the White House lawn? You know, why don't they make contact? And he said, well, quite the contrary, actually, from the cases that he'd studied, most of the time when the actual occupants, beings, entities, whatever you want to call them, were spotted, they quickly got back in their craft. They were taking soil and plant samples.
Right.
They'd get back in their craft and off they'd go.
Right.
It's kind of funny.
You know, I wrote a book on biblical UFOs where I think a lot of these things that they saw 2,000, 4,000 years ago were, you know, Ezekiel's wheel within a wheel and what have you, were UFOs. We're the same
thing.
The same thing they were seeing today, but these beings would get out and speak to them because, you know, these guys revered them as angels or God himself or gods. And, you know, what could they do if humans became hostile, throw stones at them? But today, I think they realize we can do more than that, you know. We can nuke them, for goodness sake. So.
Well, you know, Tim Lay, he's one of the witnesses from the Phoenix, Arizona case, 1997.
Right.
He was a very profound experience for him, and he associated that experience with God, you know, in modern day. So why not back then?
Why not back then? I mean, you know, you read about it in all religious texts, all based on these beings coming down from the sky in chariots of fire, you know, or brightly illuminated craft, and getting out and conversing with them. So, that what do you think's happening today? Same thing, you know. And as like you say, you know, you don't want to get into the hybrid babies aboard a craft and in jars or whatever. But at the same time, I always say, you know, these beings don't come all these light years away or through wormholes just to put on an aerial show for us. You know, what would we do if we went to another planet and we had the ability to get there and found an intelligent and yet primitive,
somewhat intelligent.
Right. Somewhat intelligent.
I'm still looking for signs.
So are they.
I'm kidding.
But I'm not. Anyway, what would we do? Well, what would we do with our own animals in the forest and in the jungle? We capture them, anesthetize them, examine them, tag them, go back, find them again. We'd do the same thing on another planet. Why wouldn't a more intelligent species do the same with us? Don't get me started on this, James. I got to take a break here once again and remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves here in Dearborn out of Henry Ford Community College. And I'm David Twitchell. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. We're speaking with documentary filmmaker, the producer of Out of the Blue, I Know What I Saw, and soon to be another untitled documentary on the Horizon Oil disaster, Mr. James Fox. Okay, so we're talking about the movie I Know What I Saw, documentary, and we talked about the Rendlesham Forest case, and there was also the Japanese UFO incident that was discussed at in the movie at the press conference. Tell us what happened in that case.
The case where Kenju Tarachi, pilot of Japan Airlines,
right?
I think it was flight 1628, okay. Alaska over Alaska, 1986.
Okay.
Well, it's funny actually because initially I had spoken to former FAA official John Callahan, and he said, "Well, I'll show up in Washington."
Mm-hmm.
Provided you can get the pilot, Kenju Tarachi, to come as well.
Really?
Other than that, I'm not interested.
Huh.
So, like...
Yeah, because John Callahan was with the FAA, and his big case, his evidence, is the Japanese case.
He's got a lot of evidence, too. He's got the radar recordings.
Yeah.
He's got the flight data. He's got the voice cockpit recorder. He's got descriptions of the craft directly taken from the eyewitness accounts. I mean, it's just amazing how much.
But there's evidence. No evidence. There's
the
no
CIA,
evidence.
I think it was the CIA.
Yeah.
Tried to confiscate it all, and he had copies of it. But he basically said, "Look, if you can find Kenju Tarachi and you can get him out here, I can well give it a shot." So I hired a private investigator. It was very expensive.
Mm.
I had sold shares of Out of the Blue to raise some funding to put that event on. Mm. For I know what I saw was quite craftily done, I might say.
Mm.
To my own horn a little bit. I had to get very creative because I don't have much money.
Mm.
At that point, none. So, but in any case, I hired this private investigator, and we located Kenju Tarachi out in the countryside outside in Japan.
Mm.
And so I called up a friend of mine who spoke Japanese, and I said, look, can you teach me just the very basics in Japanese? You know, hello, my name is James. I'm looking for Kenju Tarachi, you know, that sort of thing. So I wrote it all down. I practiced a few times. Got the phone number from this private investigator, called the house. They picked up. It was his wife. I did my little brief introduction, and she said, before I even had a chance to say anything further, she said, he no talk about an incident. I was like, but wait, no talk about an incident. Click. I paid thousands of dollars for that. So I had to call John. I said, John, I spent 6 weeks, thousands of dollars. I've gotten the telephone number. I spoke to his wife, and that's as far as I can get. Please come, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so he did. He did come. He's a funny guy, kind of a cantankerous old guy, but he was great.
Uh-huh.
And he had the crowd sort of mesmerized. He's very, very engaging, very dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
And very, very convincing, you know, of his story. And I went and actually flew out there's a very brief statement on camera from him and his wife. It's actually his wife standing next to him talking about, you know, why John came forward and was John worried about coming forward. And, mm-hmm. you know, he's a patriot and firm believer that the people have a right to know.
Right.
And that's a very compelling case, you know.
Right.
And I understand recently that Kenju Tarachi has actually come forward in the last year or so. I'm actually going to see if I can track him down. But I think he's no longer a pilot. He's retired. So maybe he's more comfortable talking about this. Because, you know, he lost his job.
Over that?
He lost his job over that, but he got it back. There was he was just saying what happened. Can you imagine losing your job when you're just telling people what
telling
happened?
Telling the truth, yeah. Well, that's why most pilots won't come forward with it.
Oh, well, you've got the case. Remember the case that happened, I think it was 07 or 06 over O'Hare Airport?
Oh, yeah.
I talked to witnesses firsthand, working for United Airlines,
mm.
and these witnesses were like, there's no way we're coming forward. Here's mm. what happened, but I'm not going to talk about it on camera.
Okay.
I said, any witnesses coming forward, you get $10,000 apiece, because I found an investor that was willing to, the story was that important to us, couldn't do it.
Really?
That'll barely cover our legal fees. We will lose our job talking about this. But somebody did send me the FAA tapes, which I have. I don't know if you've heard them or not.
No.
It's amazing. You got people in the tower while it's happening, talking to guys on the ground with United Airlines. I'm not high. I'm not drunk. This is what's happening. And the people are saying in the tower, are you kidding me right now? No, we're not kidding. This is happening. We're looking at a disc over the airport.
Oh, my goodness. Do you have that? Do you have that on computer?
I do. I'd be happy to share it with you guys.
Could I put that on my radio
Absolutely.
Show? Oh, I love you.
Remind me. Send me an email, and I'll be happy to send it to you.
I will do
that. You'd have to wait a week or two, because I've got all the stuff on my hard drive back in San Francisco.
Okay, that's no problem.
Yeah,
I will.
I'm out here in New Orleans right now.
Okay, no problem. I'll make a note of that right now.
I will gladly send you those files. Upload them to an FTP site or something.
Yeah.
Wow, but let me talk a little bit about, I don't know if your listeners, this might be interesting to your listeners.
Uh-huh.
I had managed to get Steven Spielberg to look at this film just prior to it coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Just negotiating with History Channel at the time.
Right.
Very big deal. It took a long time to get to him. As you can imagine, I've had better luck getting in touch with the President of the United States. I mean, I've gotten Carter and Gerald Ford, and
right.
I've gotten close to Clinton a number of times. I know he's seen the movie. But in any case, Steven Spielberg watched the movie. And he was very impressed. He wrote a letter about the film and about UFOs in general to Larry King. Larry King very kindly gave me the letter, the original, so I have it up on my wall in a vacuum-sealed frame.
Right.
You know, with UV-protected glass and all that stuff. And,
good.
And so I contacted, it's Marvin Levy.
Okay.
It's the publicist for Steven Spielberg.
Okay.
I said, hey, I've got this letter from Steven. Oh, wow, okay, yeah, I heard that he watched the movie, you know. And I'd like to extract a quote. I've already got it. It's right here. I'd like to use it for my movie. Very compelling. Steven Spielberg. You can imagine what that would have done. It would have been amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And Steven wouldn't do it.
Really?
He He wouldn't do it. And I got really upset. I thought, you know, here's a man who's based primarily most of his career on UFO, alien, extraterrestrial-related themes.
Right.
You know, biggest blockbusters, E.T., Close Encounters.
Mm-hmm.
That he did that miniseries, Taken. He's an advocate, obviously, for disclosure. He says as much in his letter. He wants government transparency. He was encouraging Larry King to continue his pursuit of this subject and hope that someday soon, you know, this stuff would all come out, blah, blah, blah. And yet he's not willing to do anything behind something real, something, you know, a documentary, not a film, but a documentary. He's not willing to get behind it at all. And I was very, very disappointed. And I even said as much to his publicist. You mean, you know, all the stuff he does, he's an advocate for government transparency and disclosure, and he's all a firm right. believer, blah, 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 and yet he's not willing to do anything at all to endorse her to make that happen.
My God.
Very disappointing.
Yeah, I guess. I'm writing to him. I'm going to write to him.
Yeah.
My goodness, that's something.
Well, hopefully someday I'll be able to go public with the letter.
Well, that's good. Yeah, that would be great if I could have those tapes. How long are they, dude?
Oh, you're talking about the FAA tapes right
yeah,
now?
Yeah, yeah, getting back to that.
They're long.
Really?
Yeah, you'll have to sift through them. They're like 20, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes?
Oh, that's fine. It's an hour show.
I'll be glad.
Oh, boy, that would be great.
Very, very happy to send those out to you.
Yeah, yeah.
I should put more stuff like this on my site.
Yeah, really?
There's so much material. I've got hundreds of hours of interviews, right. And we have to condense it down to 2 hours, you know, an hour and, what is it, 96 minutes total running time?
Yeah. I don't. You should know. You also had the Iranian pilot on the.
Oh my God! Was that a chore?
Yeah. How'd you get him?
Okay,
over
so
there?
We're going for the cream of the crop.
Right.
That's a very significant case. It's a case that's been covered in the Cometa report. I was going to France shortly after the National Press Club conference to interview the very man who spearheaded the whole operation, General Dennis Leddy. With the Cometa report, and I know that was one of the cases that was intensely studied by the panelists, the scientists.
Right.
And so I felt it a very significant vetted case, and to have that witness, you know, he's a general, he's a pilot, and you know about the story of 1976, going up to intercept UFO, he tried to shoot at it, it caused his malfunction in his plane, he's sort of falling out of the sky, he was moments from ejecting out of the cockpit. Amazing case. And not only that, you've got the U.S. government showing up right afterwards to investigate the case. And there we have the Air Force or whatever saying that they don't investigate. The government, if you make any inquiries about UFOs to the government, they'll send you this sort of template response that they terminated Project Blue Book in 1969,
right.
That they no longer investigate UFOs.
Right.
And yet every single case from Belgium, from South America, Tehran, Iran, France, England, all had visitors, all from the U.S. government, representatives from the U.S. government, investigating those cases all the way up into the 80s and 90s.
Right.
So they're totally and blatantly lying to us. We have documentation and on-camera testimony from generals and colonels saying that the U.S. government is fully investigating these cases and all around the world.
Well, John Greenwald told me that these are sent to... these files on UFOs are sent to the National Security, NSA, or no such agency.
Yeah.
And the NSA is not subject to the Freedom of Information Act, therefore they can say we don't have them and you can't find them. Except those files are also shared with Canada, and Canada's Freedom of Information Act is more lax. So Greenwald went over and got a lot of UFO files from Canada that were from America's NSA. So it's a
and there's been stuff released from the DIA, from the FBI. From, I mean,
yeah,
there's so and they're taking it very seriously. Have you ever heard of the Allagash? Well, let me go back for a moment. I'll tell you very quickly about getting the general to the U.S. That was a feat in itself because I get a phone call. I'm actually going to go down the Grand Canyon. This was in probably late August of 2007.
Mm.
And November's coming up quickly, as you can imagine, putting this big event on in Washington, D.C. We'd already locked down the location, the space, everything else. flight, you know, witnesses. And Leslie King calls me, and she said, well, I've gotten in touch. We've managed to get in touch with General Parviz Jafari. He's willing to try and get, he has to go to Dubai to get a, try and get a visa, but it's going to cost $5,000 just to see if he can get the visa. So I had to make a decision right there on the spot before going down to the Grand Canyon for 2 weeks, almost 3 weeks, whether I thought it was even worth spending $5,000 just to try and get the visa. I wasn't sure if he was going to get the visa. Apparently I had to fly to Dubai a couple of times and the application and hotels and plane flights. And so I went for it, and I sent them a check for $5,000, and I went down the Grand Canyon. I was off the radar completely for the better part of 3 weeks. And when I came back out again, I was very, very pleased to find out that, because remember, that was the axis of evil, Iran.
Right.
So the relations were, you know,
a little strained, tricky. A little strained, yeah.
You know, flying out a general to the U.S.
Right.
That, you know, I was like, we'll see what happens with that. So anyway, so we did that, and he got the visas. And that's how we got General Parviz Jafari.
That's great.
He actually came out for a couple of weeks.
And he told his story of being chased by a UFO.
He did. Yeah. And he brought some additional material. Like, there was a recreation video that was made by the Air Force, I think, a year later, with all the original planes and the original pilots.
And that is in your
that's
film.
That's in the movie, yes.
Yeah. So do you plan on doing yet another?
Well, every time I've said, like, I finished my first film I did with the Discovery Channel years ago, 97, 98. It was 97, 98. UFOs, 50 Years of Denial, and I said I'd never do another UFO film after that one. Then I did Out of the Blue.
Yeah.
And I swore up and down I would never. I told Larry Landsman of the Sci-Fi Channel right after selling it. I said, I'm done. I'm never going back. We had a good laugh, and that was that. And then I revisited with the, you know, sole mission of just sort of revamping Out of the Blue. I mean, I sort of lost steam in 2003, and my investors and my partners were exhausted. They were done.
Right.
And so we put it out feeling, I put it out of the blue. I was happy with it, but it wasn't what I wanted it to be. It wasn't what I set out to accomplish.
Oh, I thought it was great.
Well, then I revisited, and we did another version that we revisited in 06. And then, of course, that led to I Know What I Saw. So I've learned, never say never.
No. But you know what? Let me make a prediction here, right here on this show. Another Stevensville case is going to come up, something equal to or greater than the Stevensville, Texas case. And you are going to be right there with your cameras rolling and making another documentary.
It would be difficult not to, wouldn't it?
It would. Because Stevensville was covered in that, and I Know What I Saw.
Yes.
And
you know what's funny about that? I was in Phoenix with a film crew. It was January of 08. Get a phone call, and it's CNN, and I was losing my voice. And I had this film crew. We were spending a couple of days in Phoenix. We were flying to Chicago where I was going to do some research in Chicago. I was going to go to O'Hare and see what I'd come up with. Well, I get a phone call from CNN, massive sighting over Stephenville, Texas. Can you go on Larry King tomorrow night? So, long story short, I called the travel agent. We cancel all the tickets to Chicago, and I reroute the crew to Stephenville. So we were on the ground within 24 hours. We were ready. Those guys got a flight that night. I think they arrived late that night or the first thing the next day. We got on the ground. I went to New York. I did the Larry King show, and then they flew me from there and dropped me off all the way in Stephenville, Texas, which was great. And so we were there fresh.
Right
after it happened. So that was amazing.
And you've interviewed a lot of witnesses. Do they seem like very credible witnesses in Stephenville?
You know, I was amazed at how, like the salt of the earth, that the Texans were so kind and hospitable and
they're
down to earth. Just really, really good, solid, hardworking, honest people. Right. I was very impressed.
Right. And a lot of skeptics there before this happened, right?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. I mean, the guy that I interviewed, Ricky Sorrells, which took me a while to get him comfortable enough to go on camera, he was being harassed by the military, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Angela Joyner on the show, and she told me about they were buzzing his...
I was there when it was going down.
Really?
He's a big guy. You know, he's loaded. He's got guns everywhere in the house. Real nice, sweet guy.
Yeah.
Really good guy.
He said he was
going to... He's a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah.
And he was scared.
Yeah.
He was scared.
Mr. James Fox, once again, tell us where we can go to check out your work on the web.
You can watch a trailer, and hopefully if you like what you see, you can purchase a copy of I Know What I Saw on DVD. I'll even sign it over for you at IKnowWhatISawTheMovie.com. Or if you just Google I Know What I Saw, the website will pop up. It'll be the first thing that pops up.
Mm-hmm.
You can watch a trailer. You can buy a DVD.
Yeah.
This is a grassroots effort here.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's the official release DVD, 30 minutes of outtakes from the History Channel that we put together. It's the kind of film I stand behind. I can honestly say I do not think, no matter how skeptical you are, you could watch this film and conclude there's nothing to it.
Really?
No one's done it yet.
Right. James Fox, I really appreciate you coming on and talking with us. Hope we can do it again sometime.
I can't thank you enough for having me on, David. I really appreciate your support.
Okay, thank you. And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. And this show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at whfr.fm's website. Click on the forum button on the homepage. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, ufoimplications.com. That's ufoimplications.com. Please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, for the best in alternative programming. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, I'm David Twitchell, reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
WHFR Dearborn.
WHFR.FM, the station making waves. I'm Jeff, and you are listening to One Chord to Another, which happens Tuesdays from 2 to 4 p.m., playing new and slightly used indie rock and pop. Thank you so much for joining me today. Got lots of great music coming up. Just want to remind you that you can call in and request a song if you'd like at 313-845-9676. That's option one to get me right here in the studio. Again, that number for requests or your comments is 313-845-9676. Again, thank you so much for joining me. Gonna have a lot of fun today. Got lots of great new music we're gonna get to, including this music that I'm going to get to.